Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome all, this is Greg Soden. Thank you so much for joining me. Throughout the years of making podcasts about religion, one of my favorite things to do has been to pick the brains of my colleagues from the classroom to see what their practices are like. What do middle school teachers and high school teachers who discuss religion do to keep curriculum engaging and constitutionally appropriate for our secondary students? How do teachers help students engage with practitioners and experts? How do teachers engage the local? How do teachers frame experiences aimed at religious literacy? This episode features my conversation with Corey Wozniak, a teacher from Las Vegas. In this episode, Corey walks me through his journey into finding a passion for teaching about religion, what it's like to teach about religion in Las Vegas specifically, some of his favorite curriculum activities he does with his students, and the day-to-day life of his career. We also discuss Corey's amazing article, The Buddha at the Bellagio, Teaching Religion in Sin City, which came out in the March 7th, 2022 release of The Revealer, my favorite online magazine that explores religion and its many roles in society and people's lives. The Revealer is published 10 times a year and takes on how religion shapes and is shaped by the complexities of culture. This conversation with Corey was an absolute delight. Corey and I have been friends for several years at this point, and it is a real pleasure to chat with him about his work on the podcast. So I really hope that you enjoy it. Thank you so much for joining me. Corey Wozniak, thanks for joining me.
Oh my gosh, my pleasure.
It is a delight to have you here, Corey. I'm so happy that you're here. Before we get into, you know, all kinds of great stuff, I'm just wondering if you can just spend a second and introduce yourself a little bit to the audience, however you see fit.
Okay. I am a high school teacher. So I've been teaching in the Las Vegas Valley for 8 years. I started my career here in Las Vegas straight out of college and have been here ever since. I teach English classes, but our conversation today will focus on my religion class, my world religions class, which I founded at my school, and I'm having a blast teaching. I'm also a family man. I have three young boys that I'm raising here in the Valley.
Fabulous.
I think that's everything.
Nice. Okay. So what I want to know is, how did you come to care about teaching and find your way into this niche world that you and I kind of inhabit about teaching high school religious studies? Like, tell me about this pathway into education and then how you found your way to where you are today.
Yeah. You know, it's hard to know where to start, you know, but I think generally I was in college. I thought I was going to go to law school, and I started coaching soccer for young people, and thought, these young people are awesome. They're so fun to be around. And so I was like, no, you know, I don't want to do that. I want to go and be with young people. So I was not studying education. So I got into education through the Teach for America program. This is back in 2014. They placed me here in Las Vegas And I've been here ever since. As for teaching religious studies specifically, I teach at a really cool and nimble charter school. And I approached my principal and said, hey, this is a personal interest I have for reasons X, Y, and Z. I think that we should teach, you know, this to our young people to make them well-rounded citizens. And he's like, go for it. So I threw posters up on the wall and recruited a tiny little class, and the rest is history.
You know, over the last couple of years, like, you and I have like had these like random bursts of texting, and then, you know, information sharing and like assignment sharing, and like where I've tried to like gather together some curriculum materials and send them your way to give you a couple of ideas. So we've almost been like a mini PLC sort of like teaching from afar, which has been pretty cool.
Incredible.
But like something that I'm hazy on is how we got to even chatting in the first place. Like, can you tell me, like, did you find me or did I find you? Like, how did we get into this? And, you know, I'm wondering like if what your recollection is of how you and I got to chatting, because it is very fuzzy to me, but it feels like it's been going on for a long time.
Yeah. You know, in fact, I think this is the first time we've spoken face to face. Yeah,
it is for sure.
I found you on Twitter of all places. So this is
I'm relentless.
Yeah. You know, so I'm about to start this religions course, and I just started following all accounts that I could find. And as you pointed out, this is an incredibly niche little community. And so I found you immediately. And you were just really responsive, and so I'm just really grateful for our little friendship. And then you turned me on to a couple other teachers who have no idea who I am, but who have become kind of mentors to me because I'm using their resources and following them on Twitter.
Nice. Who are you super into following? Tell me some of your favorite people.
You know, George Coe has no idea who I am, but again, I frequent his website and pirate his stuff, and he's been a mentor for me. Yeah,
I love it. George Coe, episode 90 guest of this podcast.
Very good.
What a delight. So hi George, if you hear this, we are both fans of you doing your work down there in the DC metro area. Okay, so I want to know about your course. I'm not currently teaching in a classroom. All of my teaching that I do right now is currently 100% online. So my life today compared to like 5 years ago is extraordinarily different, but I'm still teaching and I'm still doing this work. So I'm curious like how things may have developed for someone like you who is still in the classroom. And I'm wondering if you can like kind of give me an overview of your course, how it's organized, how it's set up, if it's like a year, if it's a semester. Tell me about like your sort of sequence that you go through in your course.
Yeah, so I'm privileged to teach the course all year long. So from August until June, which
amazing.
Is sweet.
So
yeah,
good.
I couldn't imagine teaching it in a semester. Anyway, and then, you know, as I talk about the outline of my course, I guess I should qualify and say that my course is evolving. This is the second year that I've taught the course. And last year when I taught it for the first time, I taught a great portion of that, online to students through Zoom. And so my schedule is different this year and I'm adapting now that I have, students in person. So anyway, last year I taught, 6 units. I taught an introductory unit to kind of religion in general. We'll call this unit zero. This is where I'm teaching terms like scripture and ritual and so on and so forth, giving them some vocabulary to come into the study of other religions. Then we do Hinduism, Buddhism. We did Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. That was last year. This year, it kind of remains to be seen, but I've added Confucianism, Taoism, and Yoruba religion to the curriculum. So that's been a cool addition too. We'll see how my pacing is. I think I'm a little cramped for time, but
yeah, Do you have a like a course text that all students have? Like, what are you doing for like materials and curriculum? Like, what are you leaning on?
My kind of unofficial textbook for the course is Stephen Prothero's God Is Not One text.
Great book.
I find it really accessible for my students. They can read and understand most of it, which has been great. And then I've leaned pretty heavily on some other texts to Houston Smith's classic book, and then some great courses as well, which have been really useful courses on religious literacy, and they come with really nice little outlines and things. So the primary textbook is Prothero's book.
How do you get, like, what are you, is there some way that you enjoy kind of breaking down those chapters with students? Because I would, whenever we would do a chapter of that book, the students would read it over the course of a couple of nights, and then we would have just like a gigantic class discussion, Socratic, big giant circle in the room, et cetera, et cetera. Are there any ways that you kind of like seek to, you know, tease out some thoughts and reflections on those chapters with the kids?
I'm kind of figuring that out, but oftentimes it's me pulling quotations. I actually haven't assigned whole chapters to my students at all, but I mean, we use it nearly daily.
Nice.
We'll start with a quotation to kind of frame our discussion, our reading of other things, and that kind of thing. It does a really good job of laying foundations.
Cool. Nice. I'm curious about how you're doing assessments in your course as well. I never did exams or anything like that in my course. We did a variety of other kinds of assignments, and I want to highlight a few of the assignments that you want to discuss for your courses. And I'm curious if there are a few assignments or major projects that you do with students that you're like super proud of. I'm just curious, like, what you've got students to make that you have been, you know, really, really stoked about.
Yeah. So I have given my students a few, you know, traditional written exams, but I think the course does lend itself more to other kinds of assignments and assessments.
Yeah.
I really like starting the year. This is another thing straight from Prothero's book. I do not claim, you know, this is not original to me, but he has the students invent their own religions.
Nice.
And my students, oh my gosh, they just had a ball. Some highlights, one group made a religion dedicated to Nicki Minaj. That was a hit. Anyway, they go through and they invent rituals and holidays and the whole dang thing.
Yeah.
And that really gave them, it was just really useful for them to think about all the different components and categories of what makes religion. And so we do that. We just finished an assignment that I really enjoyed. This was the structure is called a pinwheel discussion. And the idea is that you have, instead of a Socratic seminar, a circle, you have several branches of this pinwheel, and each branch is assigned a character or a persona. They assume that persona, and then they engage in discussion as if they were that character. So we just did a pinwheel discussion in which students were assigned the roles of either the Buddha, Confucius, or Lao Tzu, and then they discussed questions as if they were those people. And that was fascinating, and I liked it because it forced them to bring the ideas of these thinkers in conversation, literally in conversation with one another, because often, you know, it's really easy to study religions in, you know, and box them in their own little siphons, but it's really cool when they can converse with one another about the same ideas.
You know, as a teacher, I walked out of school more days than not, like, beating myself up about things that weren't going right. And, you know, teaching about religion is an insanely hard area to live in. And I'm wondering if you know, are you having any like challenges or stresses or concerns with like your own work that you're like kind of processing in real time at all? Like, what are some things that you're, you know, still trying to kind of hone out and smooth out as you go through this process?
Yeah. So I think my biggest challenge is that I'm not a religious studies scholar.
Sure. Me too.
I'm an amateur, and I try to be really forthcoming with my students about that fact. Like, hey, I'm learning these things along with you.
Heck,
you
know, yeah.
I mean, the unit that I'm teaching today, I read a book on last week. Okay.
Yeah, like
this is real time. And so I try to, anyway, but this is one of my challenges. One of the challenges that I kind of have been thinking about recently is I have a student in my class who practices Santeria. Mm-hmm. And we were doing kind of African traditional diasporic religions, and having her in my class was very cool. But also I felt very kind of vulnerable, and like, you know, I was kind of tentative in the things that I was teaching, because I wanted to do right by her, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that was kind of a unique challenge for me. But I think the way that I compensate for that is I tell the students forthright that, you know, I don't pretend to an expertise that I don't have. But then I also am adamant that I'll bring in actual experts to come into my classroom and to speak. And, you know, I invite, you know, or I hope, you know, at the end of the unit, when the speaker comes in, they can kind of correct some of the the things that I maybe mistaught or misconceptions that I had or that we developed together.
That's
my strategy.
I'm glad to hear that you utilize guest speakers. That was one of my favorite things to do, is to bring in people from the community into the classroom that students could have direct engagement with people who, you know, practice certain traditions. Yeah. And it was so important to me to do that, because then I would get to model my own learning, because I would ask like questions that I actually wanted to know in real time. Cause I'm like sitting in the desk with the students and I'm like, oh, like my hands in the air, like a puppy, you know what I mean? Like, oh my gosh, calling me.
Absolutely.
And so I think that was one of the most influential things I ever did as a teacher for myself. But a lot of times that guest speaker thing can go wrong or can be controversial with the community.
Yeah,
and I'm wondering about how you go about making sure that your guest speaker appearances go as well as possible.
Great question. So I guess I have different kinds of guest speakers. So, mm-hmm. You know, oftentimes I'll have academics come in, and I think they, because they teach in university settings and things like that, they know kind of how to speak to a lay audience about religion and what it means to teach in a public school and things like that. And they don't really need all that much coaching, but it can be a little hairier if you're talking to a practitioner of the religion, and it gets that line gets a little blurrier. Most of the time though, we are going to these people's spaces. So like we're going to the Hindu temple and we're acting as observers, and there's as we sit there and observe, we're guests in their space, and I just tell the students, sit back, watch, absorb all you can, write down your questions. And that's worked really well. You know,
cool.
I haven't run into any real issues. Yeah.
Nice. I like to see that kind of work being done too by teachers, because it engages with the hyper local. So instead of things being out there far away, hundreds or thousands of miles away, it's right in front of you with an actual tangible experience. And I want to talk about Vegas, because where you live, Vegas, Sin City, I was delighted that an article came out written by you in maybe my favorite publication in religious studies, The Revealer. I love The Revealer. I read it all the time. And I think that I think that Brett Crutch does an amazing job with The Revealer and the podcast over there. And so this was fabulous to me. So you have a new piece called The Buddha at the Bellagio, Teaching Religion in Sin City, which came out March 7th, 2022. And I want to know what instigated the writing process of this, how this idea came to be about. Tell me about your foray into writing about your job.
Yeah. it started, where did it start? So I'm not originally from Las Vegas. I grew up in Southern California. I did school at BYU in Utah, and so I drove through Vegas a lot. I didn't spend a lot of time in Vegas, but Vegas for me represented something, you know. So I had ideas about what Vegas was.
Yeah, it's loaded. It's a loaded idea.
Yeah, and so Vegas was Sin City. Vegas was Sodom and Gomorrah. Okay, Vegas was like billboards that you know, I should avert my eyes from. You know, that's what Las Vegas was to me. And then I moved here. I was actually assigned to Las Vegas by Teach for America. And I came here, and my perspective on the city changed. You know, and so this is kind of where it started. You know, I was fascinated by this kind of the aura of Las Vegas as Sin City, and the reputation that it had for itself. And then all these, you know, pockets of genuine religious practice and religious iconography in kind of surprising places. I start my piece talking about how the Buddha is on billboards everywhere around the city for the Tao nightclub. And so that's really where it started. Is I would see these Buddha statues everywhere on billboards, and I noticed that there's a big, you know, a Hindu shrine right by Caesar's Casino downtown, and I'm like, what is going on here? This kind of juxtaposition between, you know, the secular and the sacred, and really it just was shocking to me, and I wanted to explore that.
Did you start noticing these statues and stuff like that, like after you got your job teaching religious studies? Like, did your view of the city kind of shift as you got further into this interest of teaching about religion in schools? Is that kind of where it all clicked into place?
Yeah. I don't think it was until I lived here myself that I began to notice religion everywhere.
Yeah. Nice. It's you know, I was listening to the I don't know if you listen to the Keeping It 101, a Killjoy's Introduction to Religion podcast with Elise Morgenstein First and Megan Goodwin, but it's amazing. And they did a recent episode about Buddhism where they talk about those like garden planters where like the top of the Buddha's head is like removed and there's like a plant coming out of the top of his head. And so, you know, they were talking a lot about that. And so I was making some connection between that kind of stuff and then your article and the way that the Buddha is used and sort of incorporated into all these different purposes, often as entertainment or for decoration. And the people who are engaging with this stuff aren't really aware of any of these teachings at all, that, you know, are important about Buddhism in general. But so that's kind of like where my brain was, is like seeing the ways that different places and people use the imagery of the Buddha in ways that are, you know, variously like a decapitating in one, and then also on billboards trying to sell people stuff or having like a nightclub experience with another. So that's where my brain was going with this. And I mean, that's kind of wild. And I'm wondering if you can just like, tell me like some other stuff that you see when you're going around town, like what else do you notice whenever you're there? I want to go on like a tour, if you will. Like if I was there, where would you take me to show me all this stuff?
Yeah. You know, I, in my article, I talk about the Tao nightclub as like kind of the perfect example of what you're describing. I mean, it's not just the Buddha. They do have a Buddha. In fact, they have a ginormous Buddha.
Yeah.
It's some 20 feet tall or something as a kind of centerpiece in their nightclub. But they also have other deities from Hinduism, from Jain religion and things like that. And they often use these statues in their promotional materials. And it's kind of shocking because you have these dancers, you know, in risque outfits posing, you know, on the laps of these statues.
Wild.
It really is. And, you know, it's really shocking and that they post these things on their Facebook promotional materials and things like that. And I think about, you know, I'm a Christian and I think about the outrage that would ensue if similar pictures were done with, you know, a statue of of Jesus.
I often think about that as well. Like, what if Jesus was like almost like used as like almost like a mascot for a sports team and things like that. Yes. And I'm just like, okay, you know, whenever you like replace something for something else, like what would the result of that be? I think about this kind of stuff all the time. This is what a nightmare my brain is.
So, you know, and it's interesting because Dow got some pushback. This group of religious leaders came together and said, this is inappropriate. But then, you know, they made some concessions. They removed some statues, but not others. It's kind of, I don't really understand why, you know, they removed some and not others. But it's pretty clear that the statuary, the icons, the religious elements are not kind of incidental, mm-hmm. but central to their marketing campaign, because, you know, they can't remove all the statues without losing a considerable kind of part of their branding, of their messaging.
Yeah. And you said they would be so expensive to rebrand if they took everything out. And I mean, so it's all about the dollars and cents here in my mind.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The Dow just opened up, they just renovated their like rooftop pool, and was not surprised to see that they have a couple more icons up at the top. So
do you just like go through there every once in a while? I'd be like, I wonder what Dow's doing. And like, you like pop into the club, like on your way home from work or something, just to like scope out to see if they've changed anything around.
Okay. So confession, I am, not a club hopper, not in the least, mm-hmm. not in the least, but
not
nor
am I.
Yeah. But I find, I do find the culture kind of, just interesting. To go back to your original question, you know, you said, where would I go?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's, I could point to particular locations, like Dow, or, as I said, like the statue of, the Hindu statue next to Caesar's. There are interesting locations where this juxtaposition is very obvious and interesting. However,
yeah.
What I would say is that it's more than that. It's more than like religious particular locations. It's the entire, kind of mindset. It's the spirit of Las Vegas that I think is kind of religious top to bottom. Mm. It's, you know, it's this idea, this kind of worship of fortune and chance. It's this, the seeking of alternative forms of consciousness, right? Mm-hmm. It's EDC, the Electric Daisy Carnival that happens every year in the springtime, which to me is just, overtly religious. Both in the effects that it, you know, it offers people, what people get out of it, but also in the imagery and things like that. It's, but it's, again, it's more than like particular locations and more a mindset. Like, people come to Las Vegas for religious experiences.
Mm, amazing. Yeah, I mean, I agree, because you go there and like all of it's like a lot of people are just like drinking and seeking other forms of consciousness. So there's a lot of that that's going on. Like, there's different pathways into different kinds of experiences. So that makes a lot of sense to me. And, you know, a lot of people, like, they kind of go off of like standard time as well, because things are open so long. So you're
you're
living different.
You know, most of the casinos, some people know this, but most of the casinos do not have any clocks in them at all.
Yeah,
because they're literally trying to suspend time.
Yeah.
You know? And it's, you know, it really is fascinating. It becomes this kind of, I don't know, it's timeless. It's removed, you know, from the mundane. And yeah.
I love it. There's a term in your article that I don't think I've ever read before. Theophany. And I'm wondering if you can like tell me about this term and like your understanding of it in Vegas and how you or other visitors could come to see this. I was wrapping my brain around this term in the piece.
So theophany to me means a revelatory encounter, a vision. Of God, or of a divine figure. And you know, this is the climax, this is the end goal for a lot of religious practice. And in my piece, I talk about how Las Vegas offers a kind of theophany because it offers face-to-face encounters with A-list celebrities who act the part of God or goddesses for many rabid fans.
Yeah. And
so I talk about, for example, the worship of Britney Spears, who was on the strip for several years. Her fans for many years nicknamed her the Holy Spears It.
Nice.
Or Godney, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I, you know, I find that really fascinating. I teach, you know, as I've said, I teach high schoolers, and I've seen that with my students. There, mm-hmm. there is a kind of, you know, they call themselves fandoms. And these fandoms have a lot in common with religions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a book that I featured once on this podcast called Punk Rock Is My Religion, which is a book that came out on Routledge a couple years back, but it was all about like almost like the spirituality of like being in a small club with a punk band on stage and like having everybody in the room, like in unison, like with the mosh yeah. pit and like the mm-hmm. pumping of the fists back to the singer and stuff like that. So I get it. I understand exactly where you're going with that. You know, something else I'm curious about is your experiences with like the little chapels all over Vegas that are like so well known for like marriage. Tell me a little bit about what you found out when you were digging into that little chapel scene.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, your listeners might have heard or read that one of the Kardashian were married, but not married to Travis Barker this weekend in a Las Vegas chapel. And you know, this is I think a really good example because they were apparently married, but they did not have a license. So it both was, but was not a marriage. Okay. So they went through the forms of marriage, but as far as it's not a legal binding marriage at this point. And I think that's a kind of good example. You know, these chapels, it seems like a lot of the marriages that happen inside them are kind of tongue in cheek, mm-hmm. you know, but they, nevertheless, they happen. And this industry is huge. It's huge for Las Vegas. You know, I don't have a number on me, but it was surprising. Surprising. Yeah.
I love it. You know, I'm just wondering if there's anything else about the article that you like were interested in sharing, like challenges of putting it together, or you know, what it was like to get this piece about your hometown published, and anything that you are feeling excited about that you wanted to share for the listeners.
One of the things that I talk about in the article is my students' rather heterodox religious beliefs. I talk about their, you know, the ways that they combine and syncretize different religious practices into, you know, wholly unique and personal spiritualities. And so I talk about how my students are Catholic, but also use crystals and tarot cards and things like that. And I'm thinking through kind of what this means for Gen Z.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't pose all that many answers. I'm making observations and kind of painting some profiles of my students. But it is interesting. It seems to me that Gen Z is more eclectic in how they practice religion, and they seem, from my perspective, to be a little less concerned with orthodoxies and with creeds. And they kind of have this, I say in the article, they take the position of buffet believers.
Yeah.
Here in Las Vegas, we're the city of buffets. They kind of go and they sample practices and things from all these different religions, and they like that. I continue to find that fascinating as I teach these young spiritual explorers.
I love that. And that resonates with me a lot too. And kind of, you know, echoes a little bit about my experiences that went from like 2012 to 2018 in my classes. And that was one of the most inspiring things, is how much students liked to see what other traditions have to offer because they're like, what if I feel like incorporating something into my life? And like, they seem just so cool and like sponges, like they just wanted to know. And it was just an endless source of fascination and curiosity. And I just, you know, I love that kind of work. I'm wondering what you're reading or pursuing or studying to continue to, you know, push your own understanding and knowledge within this content area, because I know that you're still growing as a learner right alongside your students. And I'm wondering if there's anything that you're really excited about lately that has, you know, helped you a lot.
The thing I'm most excited about is this summer, I'll be attending a 3-week institute at the Union Theological Seminary. This is through the National Endowment for Humanities. They bring teachers in for 3 weeks. The seminar is called Lived Religions in New York City.
Amazing.
I am so thrilled. So I think the idea is that we're going to see how religion is practiced by real people and kind of show that religion is more than musty texts and stuff like that, that these are embodied things that are practiced in real communities. And I'm thrilled about that, because I think thus far in my classroom, I tend to emphasize doctrines and beliefs and scriptures and things because those are easy to communicate. And because all, you know, much of my knowledge of these religions is secondhand and bookish.
Yeah.
And so I'm really excited to go and watch these things happen and bring some things back to my classroom.
You know, I went to New York City a few years ago for a concert at Madison Square Garden, and I was thinking about the podcast and all the books and stuff like that that I've read and the people that I've talked to, and there's so much in relation to New York City. I went to that Hare Krishna tree in Tompkins Square Park on the Lower East Side. I went to the first Zen Institute, which was founded by Alan Watts's mother-in-law.
Is that right?
And her husband, so Sokeon Sasaki Roshi, and his wife, Ruth Fuller Sasaki, who Ruth Fuller Sasaki is Alan Watts's mother-in-law. But they founded the first Zen Institute in the United States, and it's in New York City, right there in Manhattan. And so I was like standing out in front of this building, and I was like, wow, this is amazing. And then that tree, the Hare Krishna tree in Tompkins Square Park, I was like, this is so cool, just to think about all the ways that New York City has important spots. So I'm hoping that you get some of those amazing experiences as well at that institute. And definitely tell me how it is, because maybe I'll apply for it in the future as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm thrilled.
That's awesome. Well, Corey, where can people connect with you if they want to know more and follow along with your journey?
You know, I don't have much of a presence online. I have a conflicted relationship with Twitter and things.
Yeah.
They can email me. They can find me on Facebook.
Nice.
But unfortunately, I have a pretty small digital footprint.
All good. Well, Corey Wozniak, I have loved this chat. I hope that people will go to The Revealer and check out your piece, The Buddha at the Bellagio, Teaching Religion in Sin City, in the March 7th, 2022 release of The Revealer. Corey, thank you so much for joining me. It's been a real pleasure.
Oh my gosh, I'm so grateful. Thank you, Greg, for everything.